Today's Teisho is Shushan's New Bride, case 65 in the Book of Serenity. Shushan's New Bride. Case. Tut tut. Pshaw pshaw. Stripping, removing. Puff puff. Whoosh whoosh. Vague. Compute. Confusing. Impossible to chew. Hard to approach. Tell me, what kind of story is this? Introduction. A monk asked Shushan, what is Buddha? Shushan said, a new bride rides a donkey. The mother-in-law leads it. Verse. The new bride rides the donkey. Her mother-in-law leads it. Their appearance and style are indeed natural. How laughable, the neighbor girls imitating a frown. To other people, it increases ugliness, does not make beauty. So this is day two of our wonderful sesshin, our wonderful January sesshin. And today the weather was crisp, a little crisp and cold, as it's supposed to be in January, not 70 degrees. So it was lovely. It's like really felt wonderful, the feel of the cold outside. That's beautiful. And in our zendo, in here, everybody was sitting beautifully this morning. Really beautiful practice. And I have to say that I'm so glad every one of you could make it. I know you all have, many people have busy schedules, and somebody came in to see me and said, you know, the reason I'm here is because I've been working as a ski instructor. And, you know, it's been 70 degrees. So, bad for the ski industry, but good for us, yeah? And so I'm very glad this person could make it, and I it's one of the upsides of global warming. This person can be here. And it's just wonderful to see all of you. I have to say that I've really been impressed by the new people here. That, I just don't get it, to tell you the truth, because they're doing such a superb job. It's a little spooky, you know. It's possible that some other Zen group sent over some spies. That's what I think. You know, these people are really very accomplished, and they're just pretending to be beginners, you know, because they're doing so well. And I just don't, you know, I've been sitting across from them, and, all yesterday I was looking for the, you know, the signs of desperation and the heavy sighs and it just didn't happen. And they're sitting straight backed, and it's really marvelous to see. And I don't know what your secret is, but just keep doing it. It's marvelous. When I went to my first sesshin, I wasn't like that at all. I think anybody could have picked me out in the crowd. You know, I was the one who was hunched over on the cushion, you know, my face was a mask of suffering, I think, you know. So I'm very, very glad you're doing so well. Typically, day two is more difficult for many people. Day two is quite difficult. Just hang on. Usually on day three, people begin to turn around. You begin to get a little more energy, and So you just have to hang in there until that happens. If you have patience, it'll happen. If you don't have patience, then you know, this evening we'll hear the crunching of your tires in the gravel, which has happened, right? We all know, you know, this has happened. So around 5 o'clock I'll be sitting here and, you know, I hear that those tires and think, oh. But in this case, I'm pretty confident that that won't happen. So wonderful, really great. So, you know, for those of us who started on Sunday, this is day 4 of the session. So it's kind of a different situation for us. Because the first 2 or 3 days of a sesshin are the uphill climb. See, the uphill climb. And around day 3 or so, you get to the mountaintop. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have daikensho, but you have a great mental clarity and great stillness. You know, it's like a pond has been buffeted by the wind, and it's been choppy and so on, and then all of a sudden everything becomes still and calm, the air becomes still and calm, and the pond becomes glassy and clear, and the moon reflects in the water. You know, this is like the mind of somebody who's been practicing at sesshin for 4 days. Really begin to develop this wonderful stillness, this wonderful simplicity is maybe a better word than clarity. It's like this wonderful simplicity. Right? Everything is just what it is. You know, it's just marvelous. You know, when you are in that simplicity, you get up and you go in to eat breakfast, and you sit down at your chair, you unfold your bowls, and you look at the oatmeal, and you don't think oatmeal, you know. You're in the presence of the oatmeal. And when you eat it, it's absolutely delicious, right? That kind of simplicity is very difficult for humans to achieve. And here it is, you know, day 4 of, for those who came on Sunday. And they're in this very beautiful state of simplicity. And that's so precious. It's just so precious. I can't tell you, but if you keep practicing, you'll realize, and your experience of that simplicity gets deeper and deeper. And, you know, it becomes more and more flavorful. You know, it's like some things you do once and then you've exhausted their interest value, you know. And there are some things you do, and each time you do it, it has more resonance and more flavor. And especially, I think, important things are like that, you know. When we experience the stillness and the simplicity of sesshin for the first time, we might not register with a conscious mind what's happening. We might not say, oh, this is very still, this is very simple, you know. You might not say, oh, discriminating thought, it has abated, you know. It just doesn't. Because you're in simplicity, you don't think those things, right? And you go home from sesshin, and maybe you kind of feel like you have a buzz on, as we used to say. You know, and you don't, and you think, that was odd, you know, what was that all about? You know, I sat on my ass for 5 days or 7 days, and I had a lot of pain in my leg, and then something happened to me, and then I left, you know. And it just might be the case that you come back after that experience. And you might say, well, why am I going back? But it's because the experience of that, which I'm calling simplicity, is so sophisticated, it's so rich, that we can't really take it all in on one occasion. really, it's just so rich. And it's especially difficult for the little mind to take in. It's especially difficult for the little discriminating mind to take in. Because it's, you know, the little mind is not good with simplicity, because simplicity is really very much a product of interconnectedness and wholeness. You know, it seems like a paradox, but when we're in our simple, still mind, the connectedness of things is so obvious. And we stumble into that occasionally. And when we do, we just feel wonderful. Now, we might not be able to say why we feel good, but we do. You know, this is often the case. And the little mind can't really compute, you know, it doesn't get it. Because it's just oatmeal, isn't it? You know, it's just oatmeal. What's so special about oatmeal? You know, what's so special about orange juice? Well, there's nothing special about oatmeal in itself. There's nothing special about orange juice in itself. But when we're in the simple, still mind, it's a universe is the orange juice. See, it's the whole universe is our oatmeal. Everything, big and little, are all the same. It's all this sense of it's a experience of connectedness. It's not an intellectual understanding of connectedness. We need a discriminating mind, but discriminating mind isn't really very helpful in dealing with the real richness of life, the fullness of life. We have this other mind, right? And this other mind is in this koan. To put it this way, it's like bride's mind, yeah, the bride's mind. I haven't really, I've only known a few brides in my life. One was I've known maybe, I guess, four brides, you know, closely. One was my wife. And I remember our wedding day, and it was a wonderful day. And we didn't know what we were getting into, you know, but we were so happy to be together. And we were so, everything seemed so wonderful just because of our love, you know. And it was just, I had no idea what marriage was like or how difficult it would be or how easy it would be. And my mother-in-law was difficult to work with, you know. As a matter of fact. I felt so alive in the presence of my wife, and so that day was a really good day, you know. And then I know some other brides. My sister was a bride, and Kriti, and Jackie. You know, these are all brides, people who, and that mind is, you know, it takes great courage, in my opinion, to be a bride. It really does. It takes great courage because you're making an astonishing commitment of your whole life, and you don't know what the future is going to bring you, but you're working on trust, and you have this sense of connection to things. To the other person you're involved with, but also to like the whole package, right? Life, you know, it's a kind of saying yes to life. And the strange thing is that when you say yes to life, life says yes back to you. Yeah, it's so true. So I think the bride's mind is very simple because it's so big. You know, it's a big experience of the world, you know, and we have a kind of bride's mind on day four of Sesshin, because we're really back to that simplicity and that open-heartedness. And we don't know what the future, we don't know what today is going to bring. But there's a kind of trusting mind, right? Kind of trust and kind of a joy and brightness, sort of bright heart, bright mind. Isn't that the Kashin? Kashin? Bright mind, bright heart. That bright heart, that bright mind is so beautiful, and it's indestructible innocence, really, indestructible innocence. It's just wonderful. That's day four of Sesshin. Now, you know, I don't know how to put it, but I loved my mother-in-law, but she was very difficult to deal with, you know. This is true, this isn't a story. My wife had a much harder time with the mother-in-law than with my mother-in-law than I did, because mostly I just stayed out of the way. But my mother-in-law, you know, she was very domineering, you know, if I may say so. And she was always like the boss of her house, you know what I mean? And, you know, I always felt like I was a guest in her house, and I never felt like I could relax. I always felt like I had to tiptoe around. And my wife also never felt really very good with her mother as an adult. They often clashed, you know. Sometimes when my wife would go to visit her home, you know, she and her mother, maybe like day two, and she'd say, yeah, things went really well for day one, and then boom, you know. And usually my wife didn't do something that met with my mother-in-law's approval. There's something about something my wife did that got my mother-in-law's, got her disapproval. And then they you know, would have some kind of a conflict, you know, and then they'd patch it up, and my wife would leave quickly, you know, and come back the next year, you know. I also know a very nice mother-in-law, and that's my mother. And my sister's mother-in-law is also a very sweet person. So some of you may be mother-in-laws now, and you may become mother-in-laws. So being a mother-in-law isn't necessarily a bad thing. But in this koan, yeah, a mother-in-law. Mother-in-law is the mother-in-law's job is not to be so wide-eyed, right? Not to be so open. A mother-in-law has to sort of be like, you know, kind of skeptical, you know, skeptical. So daughter brings home her future husband and says, I want you to meet the most wonderful man in the world. And the mother-in-law says, I don't see the most wonderful man in the world. I just see that guy. So, you know, that's the mother-in-law's job, because she loves her daughter and she's looking out for her daughter, right? My mother-in-law would just sort of look at my wife and start shaping her up, you know? It's like, are you going to wear that? You know, and she just start, you know, whipping her into shape, you know, her motive was love, right? She loved my wife, and she was trying to help, but she had a kind of critical or skeptical mindset, you know. You have to be a mother-in-law. You need a mother-in-law. You need one. And a mother-in-law's insight, a mother-in-law's perspective comes from long experience of difficulties, right? We all go through life and things injure us, right? We get cheated, we get bamboozled, we get taken advantage of, people aren't always kind to us. And and you know, this sort of thing. So we can develop a kind of a skeptical mindset, a defensive or a critical mindset. And you know, no matter who comes to the door, it's never quite right. You know, it's never quite the right suitor, never quite the right groom. Yeah. And mother-in-law's looking out for the daughter, doesn't want the daughter to marry the wrong person, and loves the daughter, but, and so we need a mother-in-law. You kind of need a mother-in-law to guard the house. Yeah? And you need one. If mother-in-law doesn't do her job, everything goes to hell, you know. But, you know, there can be disharmony between mother-in-law and a bride, right? Because if you are too skeptical, too critical, too judgmental, you can't experience that beautiful freedom of absolute pure presence, pure simplicity. Yeah. So this is like a tension we all have in our lives, right? We all have a kind of tension in our lives between these two poles. And you know, a lot of Zen practice is just relearning how to be a bride, and getting some distance from our mother-in-law mind, right? Mother-in-law mind. And it's not always easy, because you know, we all have been injured. There's nobody who hasn't been disappointed, hurt, and usually that mindset has at its heart a feeling of, in my opinion, a deep dissatisfaction with oneself, you know. You know, the mother-in-law sometimes is unhappy with her own life, and unable to really love herself. This is sometimes true. Of course, this is true for fathers too. You know, my father would just look at my brother and start shaping him up, and it was love. But my father really was afraid that his son was going to turn out to be just like he was. And my father didn't love himself, yeah? So when my father looked at my brother, because my brother was really a lot like my dad, it filled him with fear, actually, because my father didn't love himself. And so he would start picking on my brother, trying to make him into a different kind of person. They had a very, as you can imagine, very difficult relationship. So, you know, most people come to Zen, in my opinion, because they're unhappy with some aspect of their lives. It may be that they have curiosity and a sense of adventure, and those things are necessary. But usually, somehow, we begin to feel boxed in by ordinary consciousness, you know. We begin to feel like, this is not a very satisfying life that I'm living. And it's good if you start on this path fairly early, to tell you the truth. Because if you're a little bit older, you can develop mental habits that make it very difficult to practice open-heartedly. People have come to practice with me who have been so trapped in a sort of like mother-in-law consciousness that they just can't let themselves believe that something like awakening is even possible. Yeah? They listened to me. One guy actually said this, I swear to you. A guy came was giving an introductory sit somewhere. It was at the It was at the convent where we were sitting. It was on a Sunday night. This, I think it was at the convent. This guy came, wasn't it? Maybe I'm mistaken, but this guy came and he sat with us. And at the end, I was talking to him privately, and he said something like, I said, yeah, you know, you just have to do this twice a day to start with. Try to do it for 15 to 20 minutes. Come back here once a week. So I gave my little speech, and he actually said, what's your angle anyway? What's your angle anyway? You know? So it's hopeless, right? I mean, this is like the mother-in-law giving the cold eye to the groom at the door, you know. And of course, he never came back because he figured there had to be an angle, you know. There's a kind of person who won't take yes for an answer. You know what I mean? I won't take yes for an answer, no matter what. Always a skeptical mind. And it's important not to feel contemptuous of that kind of thing, because I understand very well how that kind of a mindset is formed. You know, anybody who comes from a difficult background can develop a kind of a cynical or skeptical mind. And it's just easier to protect yourself from injuries if you're always thinking in terms of, it's like, I'm bound to be disappointed, right? Bound to be disappointed. And that mindset gets deeply ingrained. And if you're 50 years old or so, it's difficult, having made a habit of that day in and day out, to break out of that shell. It can be done, but it's difficult. If you've spent 30 years in that condition, it's difficult to get out. It's not impossible. But, the whole practice of sesshin is designed to get you out of that state. You know, is to basically work through that mindset, that distance, distrustful mind, and sort of start from zero all over again. It's like we're rewiring our brains, and we're reconstructing our bodies. It's like we're going back to zero, literally. Yeah. And you sit on the cushion, and the method of Zen, as I said yesterday, is taking everything away. So you're watching the breath, watching the breath, watching the breath, and if you do that, your awareness really changes, and your mind becomes very much focused on the immediate present. Memory diminishes to some degree. Intellectual reflection should, you know, stop. And basically, you are experiencing this beautiful simplicity. It's almost like being a baby again, right? You know, you're just staring at your oatmeal in the morning with the kind of baby's eyes, right? And it's beautiful. Delightful, you know, just sun on the floor is just beautiful. This is like the mind of a child, and so Zen sort of peels it all away, and then it begins to reintegrate everything in a different way. It's like mother-in-law's life hasn't worked out so well, you know, but the bride has a chance to live a different kind of life from her mother-in-law. Bride has a chance to live a different kind of life, and so this is what we're sort of up to with Zen. It's like, okay, we've been hurt, we've been injured, but we're going to go back to the innocence of pure presence. You know, the pure present. This is like baby's mind, the bride's mind, pure present, and we're going to reintegrate everything into this mind of pure presentness. Yeah? And this is the Zen project, you know. Takes about 10 years, maybe 15, no, that's not long. 15 years, you know. I think that's it takes a, you know, a decade or a decade and a half to begin to really rebuild yourself, rebuild your mind. But I don't think that's a long time. And it's a small price to pay to be happy, you know, I think. I mean, really happy, you know. You develop a different kind of awareness, you know. What we're doing in Zen practice is trying to get in touch with this bigger mind. We call it big mind. When you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching the breath, your mind is becoming simpler and simpler, more and more focused, and you begin to experience the world without all of the interference of your values and your assumptions and your fears and attachments. And eventually, you begin to enter this state of unity with the world. It's like, you know, you can be sitting here on the cushion and you can hear the wind and you can think, wind. And last night the wind was blowing, wasn't it? And you hear that wind and you think, wind. But if you are really in the moment, you know, the day is going to come when you don't think wind. It's just you're one with the wind. You know, you just feel totally unified with the wind. It's thrilling. It's absolutely thrilling. It'll happen to you. And it's not an illusion. In my opinion, the separate sense of separateness is an illusion. You know, everything is one life. This seems, and even intellectually, this is obvious, right? But experientially, we don't experience life that way. But when you go back to zero, when you get back to that simplicity, you hear the wind, all of a sudden it's like that wind is coming right out of yourself. And often people have this experience with bird sounds, you know. They'll be sitting on the cushion and suddenly they hear this bird sound and it's just like an explosion in their bodies. You know, it's just like sounds coming right out of me. Now you can't make it happen. You know, if you hear the wind tonight and you think, okay, you know, I'm going to become one with the wind. You know, it's not going to work out. You know. You have to do it by taking away, right? So you just keep coming back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath. And you get this very simple, focused mind, then something's going to happen, and you have this wonderful connectedness. You return to that sense of connectedness. Yeah. Now, after you finish with the breath koan, people begin doing the mu koan. And the mu koan is a little bit more complicated, because instead of focusing just on one aspect of the moment, that is the breath, we're going to focus on big mind itself. Big mind itself. See? And the way we do this is to call, you sit on the cushion with a straight back, you squeeze your dantian, your hara, the breath goes out, 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 and as it goes out you say, mo. See? Mo. And mu means emptiness or nothingness. Yeah? So you say, mo. And at the end of that mu, eventually what you'll notice, at the end of calling mu, at the end of your out-breath, you'll notice that your mind, if you look at your mind, it's blank and dark. This is amazing. This takes maybe, this can take about 5 years, 4 to 5 years to achieve this state, maybe a little less. But probably on average, it's, you know, anywhere between 3 and 5 years of practice to begin to be able to deeply enter this state. And when this happens to people, when they begin to notice this, at first they have a mother-in-law's mind, right? They say, oh, what's that all about? You know, it's just nothing. This is little mind's perspective, right? Little mind's perspective. When the little mind looks at the big mind, all it sees is darkness and blankness. and it thinks nothing there, nothing interesting going on there. But actually, that blankness, that darkness is so important to us Zen people, because that's the gate to the Buddhas and the founders, right? That's the gateless gate. That's the gate of no barrier. That is this door to the mountain. Yeah? Door to the mountain. One of my favorite pictures is by an artist named Sesshu. And it's a picture of two men sitting in front of a cave. And there's stairs going into the mountain itself. And I love that painting. It's ink on silk. And it's so powerful because it's exactly what Zen is all about. You know, when you face that blankness, you're preparing to enter the mountain. And the mountain is a universe, the mountain of the universe. And basically, that is the door to Big Mind itself, which is the door to the universe itself. And you sit there in front of that blankness for a long time. But what's eventually going to happen to you, is that you're going to achieve the same kind of connectedness you might have achieved earlier with the wind or the sound of a bird. So you're listening to the wind, and it feels like the wind is coming out of yourself, because actually, believe it or not, it is coming out of yourself. Not your little self, but your big self. Yeah? And you hear the bird, and it feels like it's coming out of your body, because it is coming out of your body. Not your personal body, but your personal body is part of the universe, part of the world. You know, the whole world is your body. Really and truly, it's just an illusion that that's not so. So anyway, there's a kind of unity or fusion that you achieve in the breath perception that you're also aiming to achieve in the mukha-on. So you want to become, you want to eliminate the obstacle between yourself and that blankness as completely as possible. And there's degrees of doing this, right? So once you have, once you can return to that blankness with regularity, you are halfway through the mu koan. But what I want to see is a more or less deep experience of connectedness with that blankness. Yeah? And the way we do this is by a simple act of calling mu. So when you come into the Dokusan room, naturally your mother-in-law mind is thinking, now what am I supposed to do, you know? Am I supposed to, I've got to answer this stupid koan, right? I've got to do something. And then you might say, well, maybe he's expecting me to say, you know, moo! You know, or maybe he wants me to do moo, 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 moo. So you're trying to scope it out, right? Your discriminating intellect is thinking through the issue. And this is an obstacle, of course, right? This is an obstacle. So you know, you go into that Dokusan room feeling like a fool, feeling like a, you know, this is ridiculous, preposterous, you know, who is this son-in-law anyway? But little by little, you know, you get to the point where you're thinking, well, I'm game. I'm never going to pass this koan. I'll be old and gray before I pass it, you know. And so then you come in and you look at that blankness and you call mu. And at some point, the voice of mu is going to speak. You know, I'm going to hear the voice of mu. And that's going to be a wonderful moment. You know, so this is what you're aiming at. And it's not so hard, you know, as you might think, because the truth is, your big mind really is your big mind, you know. Every once in a while, we read these things in the paper, these extraordinary stories, right? You know, a few years ago, I remember reading this story where this guy came on the scene of an accident, and he was probably not any stronger than I am. Maybe he was slightly, almost everybody's slightly stronger than I am. But he wasn't very strong, is my point. And he came on the scene of an accident, and this girl was under a car, right? You know, like a car. And he lifted the car, you know. And after it was over, he said, I don't know. He didn't even kind of remember what he'd done. And people were like astounded. They said, my God, you lifted that car off that little girl. And we read things like that, you know. That's tapping into the deep mind. That's tapping into the big mind, you know. We have this extraordinary capacity, this extraordinary intelligence, this extraordinary energy. And usually, because we live so much in the tiny, teeny, weeny, little, discriminating mind that says good and bad, yes and no, blah, 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 blah. You know, because we live there, we don't tap into this. But, you know, sometimes creative people learn how to tap into this, you know, like artists, you know, people just, you know, they don't know what they're doing, but suddenly this thing comes out on the canvas. It's beautiful. Or music, people, you know, you just, where did this piece of music come from? You know, I was just fooling around, and all of a sudden this was like, it's like possession, right? It's like, we know about demonic possession, but this is like divine possession. It's like you suddenly get connected to your big mind, and it's amazing what comes out. And it's amazing what comes out sometimes. You may amaze yourself. Scientists too, you know? They're working with these brain-bustingly difficult problems, and you go to sleep, and all of a sudden you get up and you know the answer. How did that happen? Right? But we have this skeptical mind that says, "Oh, that'll never happen to me." Blah blah blah. But you just keep, you know, you have to go to the cave. You have to go to the wall of the cave, or go to the door of the mountain, and just wait there until you have this moment of fusion with it. And it'll happen if you're just faithful in your practice. And if you keep going on with Zen practice, this will continue to happen. And little by little, you will become a different person. You will become a different, you'll become a different person. And you won't be a self-centered person. You'll be a life-centered person. Yeah, it'll happen. You just have to keep cultivating that emptiness. And ideally, see, this little scene in the koan is so wonderful because, you know, discriminating mind isn't bad. It's not bad. It just gets out of control. In the koan, the scene described is of a mother-in-law taking her daughter to the wedding, see? And she's happy too. She's laughing, see? She's laughing. She's happy her daughter's getting married. It's a good day for both of them, right? And this is like the ideal thing, where the two parts of the human being are unified. This is like total integration. Bride mind and mother-in-law mind. And you know what? The bride redeems the mother-in-law. The bride saves the mother-in-law, because the mother-in-law's lost hope, right? But she sees in her daughter a trusting mind, trusting heart, bright heart. And so she has hope too, because she knows that this is a like new possibility. So every time you sit on the cushion, it's a new possibility. The new world, all from scratch. And so we Zen people cultivate bride's mind. And when we do, we make a place for the mother-in-law in our lives too. Because the whole thing is, you need the mother-in-law to have the bride, right? You know. So this is like the harmony. And And it's a harmony also in your brain, believe it or not, you know. Somebody asked me in Dokusan why I have my eyes closed sometimes. And the reason is that I'm concentrating, okay? And it helps me to, and I'm also in a samadhi. I'm, you know, you're not supposed to be doing Dokusan in your mother-in-law mind. You're supposed to be doing Dokusan in your bride's mind, right? So I'm trying to, I am in deep samadhi a lot of the time. And somebody else asked me, why are your eyelids vibrating? And and I want to tell you, they're vibrating because that's what they do. I wondered about that myself because years ago when I went into Dokusan with Genki Roshi, his eyelids were vibrating, and I thought that is really spooky. You know, that is really weird. After a couple years of Zen practice, sometimes my eyes would be vibrating too, my eyelids, you know, they're going fluttering. And it's something I have tried to stop because it freaks me out. You know? But I can't stop it sometimes. And the reason, I did some research on this, it's my brain waves are, this is what's happening. My brain, I'm shifting back and forth between two different brain, you know, patterns, right? So I'm in my bride's mind, and then I'm in my mother-in-law's mind, and then I'm in my bride's mind, and I'm in my mother-in-law's mind, and my eyelids are going, blah, 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 you know? But that's true. That's how it is, you know. So please don't be spooked by that, okay? It's not—it's not something I can control. You know, you could come into Dokusan and I could have on the shades, right? But I think that would be spookier than or reflecting. I could have on the reflecting glasses. That would really be spooky. But it's a two minds, you know. It's like two minds, you know. And when you're apparently this fluttering happens when you're between two different brainwave patterns. I'm transiting, okay. So that's an integration of different parts of my brain, you know. And we're doing that too. So, what a wonderful thing to practice together like this. I can't tell you how happy I am that we're here. It's so wonderful to have this opportunity. Life is very unstable, and to have this kind of precious opportunity, it's just a great gift. So let's continue this beautiful path. We're all brides, right? We're all brides here. We're all going to meet our fulfillment in life with a hopeful heart and a bright mind. So let's go. It's time to go.